Good afternoon. Start this afternoon's presentation with an obvious statement. No one has ever seen God. This is a matter of experience, of course. We all know we haven't seen God, and we've never heard from anyone who's seen God. It's also a point that appears in the Bible. If you go to the first letter of John, chapter 4, verse 12, it says, "No man has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwells in us, and his love is perfected in us." But it starts off, "No man has seen God at any time." The whole point about God is that you can't see him. And there are lots of other passages that say the same thing. In fact, I think I might even have a list of a few of them. A small number of them up there. The places in the Bible where people see manifestations of God, or they see visions of God, but the point remains that God can't be seen. Says there at where are we? God who dwells in unapproachable light, who no one has ever seen or can see, can't be seen. That produces a problem, and it's frequently one which is picked up by atheists, as we can't see God. Why should we believe in a God that a God exists at all? Well, just believing in something you can't see isn't a problem. I'm quite happy to believe in gravitational fields. I can prove one exists almost straight away if I need to. I just have to drop something. But I can't see gravity. No one can see gravity. So things exist that can't be seen. So not seeing God isn't a problem, but atheists seem to think it is. There's, of course, lots of evidence that God does exist. I'm going to look at a bit of it this afternoon. Well, first thing you tend to think about when facing a question like this is the evidence of science. So let's just think about some of the scientific evidence. It generally comes in really two kinds. First of all, there's evidence of cause. The law of cause and effect, everything in this universe doesn't logically have to be like it is. It could be different. It might even not exist at all. Right, so that means that something is making it be like it is now. That's what science is about. It's looking at things and saying that doesn't have to be like that. What is it that makes that like that? So if someone looks at an electron and says, why has it got that particular magnetic moment? And then you get into quantum electrodynamics or whatever it happens to be, and you can work out why the electron is like it happens to be. There's a theory which says why it's like it happens to be. There's something that's causing it to be like that. That actually ends up with you having to say, well, what about that? Why? What's causing that to be like that? Why does it give that answer? There'll be arbitrary constants in the theory. Why are do those have that value? There'll be all sorts of odd things. And you can go back cause after cause after cause. You can start off with just the material of the universe. Where does it come from? Well, in the end, it goes back to the idea that there was a moment of creation. Everyone agrees on that. You go outside and look at the sky, you see it's black at night. That is, not black yet. Even in Preston, though, it goes black at night. And if the universe was infinite, sooner or later, whichever direction you looked at, the line of sight would end as a star. And the whole universe ought to be, the whole sky ought to be back to the surface of the sun. We'd all get fried. It isn't like that because the universe isn't infinite. In fact, it isn't infinite means it hasn't existed forever. If it wasn't infinite and it was infinitely old, then gravity would pull it all together into a big heap in the middle. So if you go out at night and notice it's dark, then you're seeing evidence that the universe was created. Fairly simple argument. But that brings you back to the problem of cause. All the things in the universe have a cause. These notes could have been different. They're caused by me writing them. And then you say, well, I could have been different. What caused me to be like what I am? And there was a time when I didn't exist. Something brought me into existence, and so on. And you can go back, cause, back and back and back and back. But in the end, you have to end up with something that doesn't need a cause. But there's nothing in the universe like that. The whole universe is made of things that need causes. Nothing in the universe that caused the universe. It must be something outside the universe. There's something outside the universe that caused the universe. And whatever it is able to cause the laws of nature as well as the universe itself. So we've got someone who got something that can produce things that are like mind. The laws of the universe are beautifully balanced, are mathematical in structure, and whatever caused them has to be able to think in mathematical terms. So we're talking about someone with a mind and a purpose outside the universe and the power to create it. That sounds very like God. The other kind of evidence is evidence of design. One kind of design you can see in the multitude of living creatures in the world, features that can only be explained by the intervention of a design. I'm not going to go into that in any great detail. You can add to that the fact that life exists at all. Probability of life coming into existence by just blind forces of nature is remarkably small. So unlikely that even in a universe as big as the one we inhabit, it's not credible to say that it occurred without the intervention of a creator with a mind and a purpose. And finally, there's the evidence of the way the laws of nature are finally adjusted to allow life to exist. I'll talk about this in a bit more detail. Fairly obviously, the laws that govern the universe allow the existence of life, or we wouldn't be here. Right? Over the last few decades, scientists have shown that if those laws were just slightly different, then life would be impossible. Let's look at an example of that. So that's a schematic view of an atom. I can promise you atoms don't look like that. Right? They're not even vaguely like that, and it's not to scale anyway. But the general idea, we've got in the middle, we've got a nucleus, which contains neutrons and protons. Around the outside, we've got electrons, which aren't little points going in an orbit. They're sort of cloud that covers the whole atom. But never mind. The point about it is that the charge, the electrons are negative charge, the protons are positive charge. We've got, in this case, we've got helium, we've got two protons and two electrons. And the like charges repel, unlike charges attract. So the positive charge on the proton attracts the electrons and it holds them into the atom. In a sort of orbit, orbital we call them. Now, if you think about the way the planet works, it's got lots and lots of atoms. The atoms are electrically neutral. There's the same number of electrons and protons in each atom. So they don't repel each other, or attract each other for that matter. They're held together by a different force, gravity, a bit weaker, so you get great big bodies, things like planets and stars. All right. Now, suppose that the charge on an electron was not the same as the charge on a proton. Both electrons were minus one charge, protons got plus one. Supposing that the charge on an electron was just a tiny little bit more than the charge on a proton. So an atom will have a small negative charge then. And a whole lot of atoms together would have progressively larger. The more you add together, the larger would be the charge on them. Now, gravity is a bit weaker than electromagnetism. So a difference in charge of one part in 100,000 million 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 would be enough to make sure that gravity couldn't overcome the repulsion of one atom for another, and there would be no bodies bound by gravity. There'd be no stars, there'd be no planets, there'd be no orbits around planets. Gravity would have been overcome by electrostatic repulsion. So we only need a very, very tiny change in the charge between a proton and an electron. Now, you might say, oh, well, that's all right, they're just sort of opposite to each other. Well, they aren't. Electrons are fundamental particle. Protons are made up of three fundamental particles, none of which has a charge of plus one. It just happens that when you add them together, the charges add up to exactly the charge on a proton. So there's two different mechanisms at work. The thing that gives the charge to the protons is a completely different mechanism from the one that gives the charge to the electron. And it is just arbitrary, so nothing can force it to be like that, that the charge on an electron is exactly minus one times the charge on a proton. That's an example of fine-tuning. If it was different by a very, very tiny amount, then life wouldn't be possible. You need stars and planets for life to exist. There's no stars and no planets, nothing to live on. There's no bright lights to produce the energy we need. We can't live. So very, very tiny amounts of the changes in the laws of nature would cause life not to exist. There are many, many examples of this. That's just one. And if you say, well, why is the universe capable of supporting life? It's just chance. Then you have to believe something unbelievably unlikely has occurred. The nice one, which is to do with the entropy at the start of the universe, we can look at the probability of that. But I can't write it down because there are more zeros. It's 1 in 10 to the power of something or other. There are more zeros in that number than there are elementary particles in the universe by a big factor. So I just can't write that number down. It's very sad, but I can't do it. Work out what's gone. I seem to have. Yes, there we go. Atheists attempt to create the illusion that science has provided an alternative to God. And they're wrong. Nothing really could be further from the truth. In reality, science provides exceedingly strong evidence that there's a creator who designed the universe and who brought it into existence. But the scientific expedition can be difficult to understand in full. If you're a layman, and there are some simpler and less technical reasons for believing that God exists, and I want to concentrate on those. So let's think about the evidence of moral facts. There is a clear distinction between right and wrong, between good and evil. So that picture, for example, that shows the entrance to the Auschwitz concentration camp, and there's no doubt that what went on in that camp was wrong. The slaughter of hundreds of thousands of people in that camp alone was a clear evil. Now, it's not just a matter of preference, it's not just saying, well, I prefer not to do things like that, or I prefer people who don't do things like that. It's actually wrong. It's not a question of saying, well, Hitler liked it, so it was okay for him, but it would be wrong for me. It's absolutely and completely objectively wrong. On the other hand, it's objectively the right thing to do to look after a sick stranger who's taken ill in the street, even at some cost to oneself. There's a chap called Hauser has been doing tests on people. One of his examples was you've got a child drowning in a pond as you're walking past. You have two options. You can just ignore it and walk on, or you can get into the pond and pull the child out. But if you do that, then you get your trousers wet and possibly ruin your shoes. Is it morally right to walk on or not? And 100% of people say no, the morally correct thing to do is to rescue the child. People all share these views. So right and wrong appear to be universal. Let's give you another example. The two people, Hauser of Harvard University and Singer of Princeton, they devised a set of scenarios requiring moral decisions. That was one of them, the trousers and the drowning child. And they put them to a number of different people, asking whether some action was right or possibly right or wrong, three categories. And here's one of them. It's a railway truck. It's careening out of control down a railway track towards a gang of workmen on the track. These are all looking the wrong way, and they're working in pneumatic drills so they can't hear. And the truck is going to go down the track, and it's going to run over them. Now, this is Digby here. There he is, standing next to a lever. If he pulls the lever, he will divert the points, and the truck will go that way instead. Now, if there was nobody else on the track there, the truck would go down there and just stop. No harm done. Everyone would agree that morally, the right thing to do would be to pull the lever. However, in this case, there's one chap on the track there who thinks the truck's going to go that way, and so he wouldn't have time to get out of the way before it hit him. So if Digby pulls the lever, then these five men will be saved, and that man will get killed instead. And the question is that right or wrong? Should he switch the points or not? Well, it's interesting there, because some people would say, yes, he saves five lives but kills one person. Some people say, well, yeah, but his action is killing one person, whereas it's nobody's action that's allowing five to die. So that's one which is debatable. That's the sort of middle line one. Another one, it's a very simple very similar one. You've got five people on a transplant list in a hospital. They all need the same tissue type, five different organs. There is no donor with that tissue type on the list. So you can't, there's no one recently died in a car accident or something that's got that. So they're going to die by the end of the day unless they can find an example. It turns out that in the waiting room, there is somebody seeing some completely different person who is exactly the right tissue type. Would it be right to rush out, kill that person, and then use the organs to save the lives of the other five? And everybody agrees, no, that would be the wrong thing. Don't know anyone who would say that, and neither they couldn't find anyone in the survey. You've got to ask, what's the difference between that and the truck one? That makes the truck one debatable, and that right. But human beings decide the same way. So we have a moral sense in us, which appears to be universal. They found that age, gender, nationality, culture, even religion made no difference. People have the same sense of right and wrong. They found a tribe that just emerged from the Central American jungles that hadn't had contact with human beings before, and they translated the dilemmas into something to do with crocodiles, canoes and rivers, rather than the more westernized kind of system. And they found that this newly discovered tribe of Central American tribe produced the same results as well. And there have been other studies carried out. This chap, this is Hauser, this is his book about it. This one here did similar thing, did experiments on very small children, too young to be able to talk, using puppet shows. So they couldn't have that time to learn culturally what was right and what was wrong. And the children were able to, you know, they knew which was the naughty, they had the option of giving a sweet to one of two puppets, one of them which was a naughty puppet, one which was a good puppet. And they weren't told that. They had them do these little plays out, and they were prepared to give sweets to the good puppet and take sweets off the naughty puppet. They could arrange that, even though it's quite clear that they had never had it explained to them, and they had never been able to cope with it. So human beings have this thing within us. We all have it within us. Different approach, but C.S. Lewis. His book's The Abolition of Man. What he did was to go through the literature of ancient Greece, modern Europe, India, China, places a long way away, places a long time ago, even on unusual cultures like Native Americans and Norsemen. And he found that the basics of moral judgments of those cultures was the same. And so there's really is a universal moral standard. So, again, think what that means. There's an objective principle which distinguishes right from wrong. Several ways of stating it. It's a very good statement of it in the Gospel of Luke. If you turn up the Gospel of Luke, chapter 6. And verse 31. Jesus says, as you would have that men should do to you, do ye also to them likewise. And that's sort of recognized as a universal moral basic principle. And it's recognized as that throughout the world. Not usually as stated as concisely as that or as well as that, but nonetheless, it's a generally accepted statement. The Matthew version of that passage comes in Matthew 7. You look at that as well. Matthew chapter 7 and verse 12. Matthew 7 verse 12. It says, therefore all things whatsoever you would that men should do to you, do ye even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. And he's pointing out that this basic principle underlies other moral systems, in this case the law of Moses. And the law of Moses fits in with that exactly, of course. It's not a problem. Circumstances can alter cases. You work it out, might work it out slightly differently in different physical circumstances. That's going to happen. Just like it is right to drive on the left-hand side of the road in Britain, but it was not a good idea to do that on the left-hand side of the road in France. I mean, there they everyone drives on the right, but you can say there's a general moral principle, which is that you should drive on the same side of the road, general principle, you should drive on the same side of the road as everybody else, so as to avoid accidents. I'm sure that's a moral principle or not, but it's certainly a good principle to hold. The same with the moral principle here that we've been thinking about. How it works out can depend on circumstances, so you don't always come up with exactly the same set of detailed rules. There is a real objective distinction between right and wrong. So let's think about its nature. So first of all, it's not just a matter of basic instinct like hunger. You know what instincts feel like. Our moral sense is different from that. It's situation dependent to some extent. The basic principle remains the same. Details may change. And I gave an example of driving on which side of the road. The Old Testament law was slightly different. They give you slightly different ethics from New Testament law because the death and resurrection of Jesus had changed things a bit, and the way society lived had changed a bit. And third thing about it is that while we know what is right and what is wrong, we don't always keep it. So everyone I think recognizes the precepts of the Sermon on the Mount as being good. A good person would, if a person could hold to all those principles, they would be a good person. None of us has ever done it. It's quite likely that human beings are not capable of doing it, or even getting close. But that doesn't mean that those things aren't right. It just means that we aren't good enough to be able to keep them all. And we don't keep the moral law that exists. There are times when we sometimes deliberately do wrong things. There are sometimes when we do it by accident. And there are sometimes when we don't do things we know we ought to do. Sometimes we even break moral principles without knowing we've done it. It's only afterwards. Interestingly, the Harvard team that did the research on this was led by an atheist who started off by claiming that because the knowledge of right and wrong is universal, there's no need for a spiritual authority of any kind to teach it. He was wrong, of course. The principle isn't just instinctive. We need help to fit it into our surroundings and encouragement to follow it. The Bible provides exactly such help. And the point was underlined when this particular principle figure in the Harvard team, in spite of having written numerous papers on moral philosophy, was found to have committed academic misconduct in a different study, and he was forced to resign his post. The idea that there's a fundamental moral principle is great, that's true. The fact that we don't keep it is also true, and that leads on to another problem, which the problem of atonement doubtless will be dealt with at a different time. I'm talking about the existence of God. So the point is that an objective moral principle exists. Right and wrong are not just matters of taste or opinion. Some things are genuinely right, others are genuinely wrong. And the question that needs to be asked is, where could that objective moral principle come from? Well, it can't be derived from any scientific principle or from any physical law. Science tells us what things are like. It can tell us that, given the law of gravity we've got, planets will go around stars in elliptical orbits, for example. It can't tell you whether it's right or wrong to do it. It can't tell you what should happen, what things should be like. If you can tell you that if you drink strychnine it'll kill you, it can't tell you whether it's right or wrong to drink the strychnine. So no scientific theory can tell you what is right and what is wrong. Secondly, you can't derive ideas of right and wrong just from pure logic. And lots of philosophers, some of them very famous ones, that's just a small handful that have tried it, have attempted to develop basic ideas of right and wrong from pure logic alone, and they've all failed. And in the end, I think it was Immanuel Kant who showed why it's what's called a category error. You can't argue from facts of one kind to facts of another kind. You've got to follow a logical argument, it's got to keep in the same kind of fact. Without a moral principle to start off showing you what's wrong and what's right, you can't argue about what's wrong and what's right. Well, lots of people tried to show them wrong and failed. So the only way that an objective moral principle can exist is if it's derived from some moral entity who has to be eternal, has to be outside the universe. They have to be able to produce a mental concept. The idea of being right and being wrong is something that happens in your mind. So it's a mental concept, so they have to have a mind. And they have to have the ability to insist on this moral principle being carried out throughout creation. So we're talking about a creator. And the only entity that can do that, a mind, a moral intent, and the ability to create things, is God. So again, we've got a God, or else we can't account for where moral principles come from. So the existence of right and wrong show that God exists. Now that's a logical demonstration of God's existence based on logic and the existence of right and wrong. I want now to think of a different line of evidence altogether. That's the evidence of miracles. So a miracle. Miracle is an event where the laws of nature are broken in order to produce some important outcome. Sometimes where it's just very, very unlikely, but sometimes when it's laws of nature are broken entirely, and I'll talk about that kind. Now that could only happen if some powerful supernatural entity intervenes to cause the miracle to occur. And the problem, of course, is that miracles are rare. That's one of the points about miracles. If they happen all the time, they wouldn't be miracles. And for most miracles recorded, we have virtually no evidence to show whether they occurred or not. So one of the healings of Jesus, for example, we have a biblical record that says they happened, but they didn't leave any other physical evidence. We can't go dig them up or talk to the person when they're long dead. But there's one miracle where the evidence is very clear indeed, and that is the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. So Jesus Christ was put to death by crucifixion on the eve of the Passover, probably in 30 AD. He was examined, he was found to be dead, his body was placed in a tomb like the one on the picture there. That isn't the tomb of Jesus, but it's like it. The stone was rolled across the door of the tomb, it was sealed, and the tomb was guarded by Roman soldiers, probably from the Praetorian Guard. On the third day after his crucifixion, the tomb was empty and Jesus had risen from the dead. That's a miracle, clearly. Let's think what evidence there is that it actually took place. Well, the most obvious evidence is the empty tomb. There's no doubt the tomb of Jesus was empty and that it existed. The tomb was in Jerusalem. Anyone in Jerusalem could go down and look at it in under an hour if they wanted to do so, so they could have their Sunday lunch and then go for a stroll and see the tomb of Jesus and get back in time for tea. No problems. Right. If the body of Jesus had been in the tomb, then no one would have believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead. But thousands of people in Jerusalem were prepared to believe exactly that, that the early Christian movement began in Jerusalem and it spread from there. Not only that, but the authorities in Jerusalem could easily have put paid to the new Christianity, and they wanted to do that, they were keen on that. They could have put paid to it by producing the body of Jesus, if they'd had it. But they couldn't do that, they didn't do it. Instead, they tried to produce a naturalistic explanation for the empty tomb. And they were still doing that in the middle of the second century. It didn't just appear in the Gospel of Matthew. It also appears in Dialogue Against Trypho the Jew in the second century. It's something that carried on being talked about, and Jews were using that defense for a long time. So there's no doubt that the tomb of Jesus was empty. And we can add to that the evidence of people who met Jesus alive after the resurrection. We have accounts of four of those in their own writing. We've got Matthew, John, Peter, and Paul. And conveniently, Paul gives us a list of other witnesses. So if you go to 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, You see the list there. Corinthians 15 verse 3, Paul writes, I delivered unto you first of all that which I also received, how that Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he rose again the third day according to the scriptures, and that he was seen of Cephas, then of the 12, after that he was seen of above 500 brethren at once, of whom the greater part remain unto this present, but some are fallen asleep. After that he was seen of James, then of all the apostles, and last of all he was seen of me also, as of one born out of due time. So that's quite a remarkable list. The number of witnesses is remarkable, there are over 500 of them, and the variety is remarkable. It includes disciples who knew Jesus well, they would recognize him, they wouldn't be fooled, well, provided he'd let them do it, of course. There's Jesus' own brother, and among the 500, there'd be others who knew. There'd be others who knew Jesus probably only by sight. Some of the witnesses were opponents before they met Jesus. James, the brother of Jesus, wasn't on Jesus' side beforehand. Paul persecuted Christianity beforehand, and the conviction of the witnesses is very strong. After the fire of Rome, sometimes before, they were prepared to suffer gruesome deaths rather than deny the resurrection. They wouldn't have done that unless they believed their own witness. There's only one possible conclusion from all that evidence, which is that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Now, the resurrection of Jesus was a miracle. Jesus rose from the dead, and that could only happen because God raised him. So, if God raised Jesus from the dead, then God has to exist to do it. So we have evidence of the God who raised Jesus from the dead. And the final piece of evidence is fulfilled prophecy. The Bible contains a considerable amount of that. I'm going to look at one strand, and that's a prophecy about the Israelite people. So if you go to the book of Deuteronomy and chapter 28, let's see what it says in Deuteronomy 28. And, well, start off at verse 1. Now, this isn't a prophecy, actually, but we'll come on to what makes into prophecy in a moment. It says this, it shall come to pass that if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe and to do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above the nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. Blessed shalt thou be in the city, and blessed thou shalt thou be in the field, and on it goes. Now, the children of Israel were given that shortly before they entered the promised land. If they were faithful, they were going to be blessed with great prosperity. But if they were unfaithful, things were to be different. So if you go down the page to verse 15 of Deuteronomy 28, you find a different picture. It says, it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and his statutes, which I command thee this day, then all these curses shall come upon thee and overtake thee. Cursed shalt thou be in the city, and cursed shalt thou be in the field. So if they were persistently unfaithful, they were to be cursed by God. And the wording of that's fairly compendious, but I'm going to draw your attention to verses 64 to 67, right at the end of this. You can read the lot if you want. It's a fairly comprehensive set of disasters going to happen to Israel, but the flavour of it, I think, comes in verse 64. If you just read that bit, verse 64, the Lord shall scatter thee among all people from one end of the earth even to the other, and there thou shalt serve other gods which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone, and among these nations shalt thou found thy found no ease, neither shalt the sole of thy foot have rest, but the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart and failing of eyes and sorrow of mind, and thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. In the morning thou shalt say, would God it were even, that even thou shalt say, would God it were morning, for the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes, which thou shalt see. So it's predicted that not only were they going to be defeated in war, they were going to be dispersed in their land, they were going to be scattered throughout the nations, and there they were going to suffer persecution. Now, that's not a prediction, neither of those is a prediction so far, because they're both conditional. If you do this, then that's what will happen. And you could say, well, they were persecuted, so we're going to say that they must have been unfaithful. But there actually is another passage which turns it into prediction, and that's in Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 1. So Deuteronomy chapter 30 and verse 1. It says, it shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among the nations, whither the Lord thy God has driven thee. Verse 3, then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. So what it's saying there is that both the blessing and the curse would come to pass. So it's not just one, it's both of them would happen. And in the end, they would be returned back to the land from which they were originally dispersed, or at least a significant proportion of them would be. Well, the blessing was fulfilled in antiquity during the reigns of the great kings of Israel, especially the reign of Solomon. Fulfillment of the curse a bit more recent. In 70 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans as the climax of a war which stemmed from a Jewish revolt against Rome. The inhabitants of Judea and Galilee were sold off as slaves throughout the Roman Empire. That's a picture of the triumph of Titus. And you can see there the seven-branched candlestick from the temple in Jerusalem being carried away by Romans in a victory parade, which is on Titus's arch. That's in Rome still to this day. Titus was the general who captured Jerusalem in 70 AD. And they then followed centuries of persecution. There, it's a medieval woodcut showing Jews being persecuted in medieval times. And of course it reached a peak in Nazi Germany in the 20th century. The people who did the persecuting were doing wrong things, but nonetheless they were fulfilling a prediction that had been made in the past. But the further element member of the prophecy is the regathering of the Jews to the land from which they were dispersed. Deuteronomy 30, verse 3, that the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and return and gather thee from all nations whither the Lord thy God hath scattered thee. If any of thine be driven out to the uttermost part of heaven, from thence will the Lord thy God gather thee, and from thence he will fetch thee. And the Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it, and he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers. And it's again well-known point that there is now a considerable Jewish population in Israel. It's become prosperous, much like a Western European nation. And if you think about all the trouble around Israel, it stands out as a beacon of pretty much calm in the area. Even places like Greece and the former Yugoslavia are suffering quite badly from what's going on in the Middle East. Israel, okay, there's occasional knife attack, and some rockets were fired at Tel Aviv the other day, but in general it's doing a lot better than most places. So let's add a second passage to that picture. Zechariah chapter 12 and verse 3. Zechariah 12 and verse 3. In that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, that all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. Yes, he's a bit clear. On that day I will make Jerusalem a heavy stone for all the peoples. All who lift it will surely hurt themselves, and all the nations of the earth will gather against it. And that's talking about the time after Israel's return, and it's predicting trouble around the ownership of Jerusalem, and it predicts that all the nations will tend to oppose Jewish control of that city, at least all the nations around anyway. And that's what you see. That's what's going on now. There's a further element of the same picture in verse 6 of Zechariah 12 and verse 6. So in that day will I make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, like a torch of fire in a sheaf, and they will devour all the people round about on the right hand and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. Predicts that the return of Jews to Israel would be incendiary. It will cause much trouble in the surrounding nations, and again, that's happened. There's no doubt that prophecy is fulfilled. And if we have time, we can go on to look at many other prophecies of the future of Israel, in Isaiah, in Jeremiah, in Ezekiel, even in the Gospels. And we've seen the same picture with additional extra details. And the Bible contains a very detailed set of predictions of the history of Israel from the second millennium BC to the third millennium AD. And the significant thing is that those predictions are fulfilled in all aspects. So let's just think what that means. The Bible contains accurate predictions of the history of Israel written well before they were fulfilled. Those passages we've looked at are found in the Dead Sea Scrolls, for example. They were copied out well before the birth of Jesus. Humanly speaking, there's no way that the writers could have known what would happen, but their predictions are accurate, and that tells us that the writers of the Bible somehow received information on what was going to happen in what for them was the very distant future, thousands of years later. No human could have given that information. We only have that information, it can come from a supernatural source, the God of the Bible. So we've seen four items of evidence which show the existence of God. We've shown the scientific evidence, the evidence of science, the universe came into existence, requires a cause outside itself. It contains living creatures that require a designer. We saw the laws of nature are fine-tuned to allow for the existence of life. It wouldn't be rational to suppose that that had happened by blind or random processes, it's just too unlikely. So that evidence shows the existence of a purposeful creator. We talked about objective moral standards. We saw that there exists an objective difference between right and wrong, and that can't be derived from pure logic or from scientific investigation. The only way such a distinction can be made between right and wrong is if there's a supernatural being who defines that difference. And the only way to account for the objective moral standard is that standard comes from God. We saw fulfilled prophecy. The Bible contains many predictions of future events. Those are mostly fulfilled, the exceptions being predictions of events which are clearly in our future. No prediction of the Bible has ever been proved false, and that's information that could only have come from God. And finally, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Didn't do them in that order, but that's the order they're in the summary. The only piece of evidence in the resurrection of Jesus, the other piece of evidence in the resurrection of Jesus, it's a miracle attested by the evidence of the empty tomb and the testimony of many witnesses. God raised Jesus from the dead, so God must exist. And the only conclusion you can draw from that is that God exists, that he's a purposeful and a mindful creator with a strong interest in the difference between right and wrong. He's revealed things to mankind, and he's raised Jesus from the dead. And that's the God of the Bible. That's a pretty good description of the God of the Bible. And we've deduced that without just going to the Bible and saying, there you are, that's what the Bible says God is like. So the God of the Bible is a just and a moral God. We can choose either to seek him out and find out about him and his ways, or we can choose to ignore him. Either way, we're making a choice. If we choose to seek God, we're risking very little, but if we ignore God, then we are gambling everything we are, not just everything we have, but everything we actually are, on the chance that there isn't a God who cares how we live our lives. That's not a very rational gamble to take, unless one has information on the likelihood of God's existence. So the only rational course is to look for evidence before we decide.